From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Observers of Utah's political culture are keeping an eye out on what seems to be a split within the state's Republican Party over the caucus and convention system. Moderate Republicans have been frustrated for years that the most ideologically extreme candidates are often selected because of the way the process works. So these moderates helped form the so-called Count My Vote petition drive as a way of limiting the more strident partisan voices and giving mainstream voters more say earlier on in the process. Count My Vote struck a deal with lawmakers to reform the system. They passed a law. And here's where the split comes into play. Conservative Republicans, among them the Republican Party chairman, are filing a lawsuit to strike down the law. A lot at stake here, some big philosophical questions, and we're talking about it all after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Utah Republican Party is asking a federal court to strike down a law passed in the last legislative session. The law was a deal struck by lawmakers and organizers of the group called Count My Vote. The Count My Vote people were well on their way to getting a proposal in front of Utah voters that would have allowed any candidate who gathered a certain number of signatures to get on the primary ballot of any political party. Opponents of the old system say the extremists in both parties have too much influence early on and that mainstream voices are being left out. Legislators wanted to stop that Count My Vote effort, so they agreed to the deal. Well, it turns out the state Republican Party is challenging that law, as I said, setting up a struggle possibly between the moderates and the more conservative members of that party. So today in the program, we're talking about the lawsuit and the implications for the state's political landscape. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Robert Gerke is back with us, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, thanks for doing this again.
Yeah, good to see you.
And Brian Grimmett, reporter and online editor for KUER News. Brian, welcome back. Thanks for being with us. So I wanted to start with a basic primer because it sounds so complicated as I'm reading that introduction. Robert Gerke, give us a sense. What was wrong with the old system? What was it that the organizers of Count My Vote initiative were after?
Well, the big thing that they say they were trying to fix was Utah's low voter turnout. For a long time in the 70s and 80s, Utah was among the tops in the nation in voter turnout. And you started seeing that decline in the 80s, 90s, and into 2000s. And one of the reasons that they postulated was that it was because these convention systems that Utah has, this caucus convention system that's kind of unique to the state, was picking candidates that were sort of outside the mainstream, that was leaving voters disenfranchised.
So when they finally voted in November,
The November elections didn't matter necessarily. They were choosing between candidates that didn't really represent them, so the voters would stay home. And so the reason for that is because you have this caucus system where the most strident, the most partisan people go to the caucuses, get elected delegates, and then they control the nominating process. And once you control the nominating process, you control the candidates who are on the ballot. And if those candidates are sort of outside the norm, then the mainstream voter's not going to feel like they have anybody who to really get behind and support. So what they were proposing doing then is changing the nominating process to give people a way to sort of get around this caucus convention system, where you could go out and gather signatures from registered voters. You gather enough signatures, you go on the primary ballot, and you can go on the primary ballot against the person that came out of the convention or other people who gathered signatures. And their theory was that this would give the average voter more flesh in the game, I guess, more somebody that they could support. So they went out and they started gathering signatures to put this on an initiative proposal. They tried it through the legislature. The legislature didn't bite on it. In fact, there was some hostility toward the proposal from the legislature when they floated it the first time. So they went out and gathered the signatures. They raised and spent over $1 million doing this. They gathered over 100,000 signatures and were kind of appeared to be heading toward getting it on the ballot. There was some question whether they actually met the threshold for signatures.
Right.
But what ended up happening was the legislature stepped in and said, look, there are problems with your proposal we don't like. We can do better. Let's talk about this. And so during the session, they came up with this sort of negotiated compromise, the grand compromise that became the law. That became the law. Incorporated a lot of what Count My Vote wanted and then refined some other pieces of it. And so that became the law. Governor Herbert signed it in April, May, I guess.
Well, and it allowed him to keep the caucus convention system because the actual initiative ballot would have gone to a direct primary.
Yeah.
And so that would have eliminated what was currently there. And so I think that was part of the reason for the compromise.
That's a good point. A two-track sort of hybrid
system. Yeah, the two-track that you were talking about earlier.
Well, so if the Count My Vote people were well on their way to getting this thing on the November ballot, why compromise? What was in their interest?
Well, I think there was some question whether they actually
were going to get there
because they gathered the signatures. They were in the process of submitting them to the county clerks. The county clerks had to verify that all of these people are registered voters, and you have some counties where, you know, the rural counties, it's really hard to meet the threshold because you have to the threshold for getting on the ballot is pretty high. You have to get it in, I believe, 25 of the 29 Senate districts, might be 26 of the 29 Senate districts. And so in the rural areas, it's kind of hard to, it's very difficult to do. And you end up, the opponents of Count My Vote still had this window where they could go out and try to get people to take their name off. And so you target some of those rural areas and you can kind of maybe knock them off the ballot. So there was
probably
some
wise and compromised.
Yeah, well, and then even if they got on the ballot, then you have to run a campaign for this, and that's going to be a lot of money. They, like I said, they've already spent $1 million. They kind of kept going back to the same sort of wealthy people, Gail Miller and some others, Mike Leavitt and Rich McKeon kicked in $25,000 each. So I think they were interested in a compromise, and I think they recognize that maybe the legislation refined some of the problems that were in the ballot initiative that they were proposing.
I wonder, do we have a sense, as you said, the point that the Count My Vote people were making was that voter turnout was low, people felt disenfranchised, that the sort of more extreme, strident, partisan voices were the ones that were having control. Is that a given? Is that in fact true? Do we have any way of knowing that? And what effect? I guess the question is, are Utah's lawmakers, the ones who are, and other state leaders, are they more extreme in their perspective than mainstream rank-and-file Utahns? Do we know? Is there any way of measuring that?
I don't know if there's an exact way of going out and measuring. There's lots of anecdotal stories. There are a lot of, you know, politicians, you know, saying one thing or another because their candidate didn't win. But I do think that there was a study done, I think it was by the BYU Center for Study of Elections and Democracies. I don't want to talk about it too much because I'm not that familiar with it, but that did talk about how under a caucus convention system both for Republicans and Democrats, this wasn't just a Republican issue,
right,
but that the more extremes did tend to be represented more in a caucus system than if a primary was the way that the elections went.
The Utah Foundation did one as well, that did a survey of delegates and did a survey of voters. And the top issues for the average voters were jobs, the economy, education. The top issues for the Republican delegates were things like fighting the federal government, taking public lands, that sort of thing. So you had this sort of disconnect in that respect. One of the other points that the Count My Vote people made is that the caucus convention system and yielded delegates who were almost entirely white males, white sort of older males. Women were drastically underrepresented. I think it was 75-25 male to female ratio, which obviously, you know, if it was truly representative of the populace, it would be 50-50, right? Maybe a slight advantage to women. So
yeah,
that was one of the other sort of disconnects that they were pointing to.
Because the question is going, and we'll come back to it a little bit later, is what would change if you change the system? Do you have a sense of that? What would change if you were able to give mainstream rank and file people who actually vote but don't vote until November,
right?
Would that have an effect on governing in this state, on the issues the state pursues, those kinds of things?
Well, I think there are some who certainly hope that would be the case. I don't know if we can point to it and say
sure
with certainty that that would be the case.
We should also point out the law does not go into effect until January.
Until 2016 will be the first election right. that will actually be in effect.
And that's if, you know, the lawsuit doesn't delay it at all.
Yeah. Right, right. So I think it's sort of hard to say whether or not it's going to end up, you know, a couple case studies that people pointed to was one when Jim Matheson got a challenge from Democratic delegates in his convention in 2010, I'm sorry, from Claudia Wright, because Jim wasn't seen as liberal enough. And you had Bob Bennett getting knocked out at convention by Mike Lee because Bob Bennett was seen as too liberal. So that's the sort of the proponents of Count My Vote think that you're going to end up with people who in office or nominated for office who are more reflective of the voters who right now are not going necessarily to the caucuses. They're not the people who are the most active in the party. So, you know, it's the people whose voices, sort of the silent majority, I guess, as Nixon might say, who aren't necessarily being represented right now.
I want to ask you about, we'll come to some of the legal issues a little bit later in the program, but Robert, you say this lawsuit has been a long time coming. I guess mm-hmm. no one was terribly surprised when it
I think, Brian, I think during the session or right after the bill passed, the Republican Party and certainly members of the Republican Party were talking about suing, and the party itself took a few votes on it, both in the Central Committee meeting and its Executive Committee meetings to support a lawsuit. James had said for...
James Evans,
I'm sorry, the chairman of the Republican Party had said for several months that they were working on it and they were going to file it. It took a little longer than he had promised. I think he was talking about August or September before. It may or may not be coincidental. We can ask him that it came right after the election.
I think another issue that he's brought up too is they were just trying to get the money mm-hmm. even to be able to move forward with the lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, and the money is sort of an interesting question in itself because the people who were supporting Count My Vote were largely the sort of the big ticket Republican donors.
The establishment,
the Republican establishment. Yeah. Yeah. And so these are the people that the party traditionally has gone to for contributions. And so it sort of pitted Republican against Republican in a lot of ways. And the Democratic Party, Brian, maybe you have a sense of this as well. It seems to be a little less split on this particular issue. This is one that's really kind of torn, you know, the Republicans a little bit more than the Democrats, I think.
Yeah, well, and the Democrats, they tend to like the caucus system, but they're not so behind it because they open their caucus even now. I mean, anybody, you don't have to be a registered Democrat to go participate in the caucus convention system. So I don't think that they see it as big of a deal as we need to control and have all the power because they've already opened it up. They're supposed to be having a press conference even, I think, this afternoon saying that they're in favor of the SB 54 compromise and that they don't really see a need for this lawsuit.
So I guess the question is then, among Republicans, whether this is going to cause, and I wonder if this mirrors the national conversation mm-hmm. Republicans are having now, the so-called split between the moderates and the more conservatives, the Tea Party types, for example, nationally. Is such a thing happening? I mean, for example, James Evans.
Yeah.
Is he a conservative or is he a moderate? Clearly, he's trying to go after this lawsuit, so he may not fit into the sort of establishment moderate category, I suppose, yet he's in charge of the party.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing James do is trying to do, and he can probably speak to this himself, but I think he's trying to sort of do what the governing body of the party is telling him to do, right? He's not fighting against them. He's not, you know, pushing them along. He's kind of taking his cues from them. But yeah, I think this very much reflects the split among the party. I mean, you have the sort of the Chamber of Commerce Republicans, the sort of business-backed Republicans who are in the Count My Vote camp, and then you have the more Tea Party sort of pro-caucus people who are very passionate about this. This is a big issue for them, and they're very much, you know, very opposed to it. I mean, just adamantly opposed. They're going to go to the mats for this thing.
And I think it's interesting that when you have a party, especially in Utah, that the Republican Party has such a majority, that it's almost inevitable that there's going to be some kind of split. I mean, when there's so many people who profess to be Republicans, trying to get all of them to agree on everything all the time. And I think, like you said, it kind of is going down along those lines of kind of the Tea Party Republicans and the Chamber of Commerce Republicans.
Yeah, and the Tea Party Republicans kind of scoff at it. They see it as sort of the establishment Republicans, the people who dominated the party, the Mike Levitts and the Kirk Jowerses, who are the establishment type Republicans who called the shots in the party for all these years. They don't like the fact that they're being kind of muscled out by this grassroots Tea Party movement, and they're afraid that they're losing control of the party, and so this is their sort of reactionary effort to try to seize back control of the party by using their money and pushing these grassroots candidates out. One of the arguments that they make, you know, to counter the sort of this and give you more mainstream candidates, it's also going to probably increase the cost of running a campaign because you're going to have to go out there and if you're going to gather signatures, you may have to hire people to do that. You're going to have to run a primary campaign and then you're going to have to run a general election campaign. And they argue, well, that's going to make it impossible for the average Joe to go out there and meet with the people. Meet with his delegates in his district, and get the nomination and get the and win the election.
It's Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Brian Grimmett, reporter for KUER, online editor as well. You can join the conversation 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. Robert, Brian, stay with us. We're going to hear from James Evans, the chairman of the Republican Party, when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a lawsuit being filed by the state's Republican Party to try to strike down a law passed during the last legislative session that would limit the power of party delegates in selecting candidates. Opponents of the old system say extremists in both parties have too much influence early on and that mainstream voices are being left out. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is James Evans, chairman of the State Republican Party, joining us by phone from his office in Salt Lake. And James Evans, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I guess the first question is, why a lawsuit now? I mean, I know you've heard this question. SB 54, the law that was passed in the session, supported by a good majority of Republicans. It was, as has been pointed out, also supported by a number of the party's leaders and supporters. Why file a lawsuit, and why do it now?
Well, like with any lawsuit, you don't file a lawsuit until you have the funding in place, because the attorneys want their money, number one. But number two, this question is about our constitutional rights, and we are a private organization. Somehow that's been missed in the discussion. I think there are those in the public that believe we're impacting their ability to vote. We're only talking about our ability as a private organization to select the candidates that will represent our party.
But Mr. Evans, how can
you have access to ballots?
How can you say you're a private entity when, in fact, your principal mission is to select candidates for public office? Aren't you more a civic entity or a public entity?
No, we're a private organization. We're not a public organization. We don't receive money from the state. We are a private organization, just like any religious organization is a private organization, or any civic organization, the Rotary Club, or any other organization that has a voice in the public space. We are not a public organization. The Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the Libertarian Party, the Constitutional Party, list them all. We're all private organizations.
So what is the limit then of the how involved can the state, or should the state, or the federal government for that matter, how involved can they, do you think, be in regulating elections? As you know, in the state, for example, Constitution, the lieutenant governor is the state's chief elections officer. It says in the Constitution it's his job to oversee all of Utah's voter registration activities and other responsibilities. So how is that not constitutional?
Well, we're not challenging that. We're in complete agreement with that. That's the citizen's right to vote, and that is regulated by the state. What we do as a private organization is put forth an individual that are individuals under our brand to go on the ballot. Just like Doug Fabrizio, if he wants to run for governor, he doesn't have to run as a Republican or Democrat or Libertarian. You can go out and get 300 signatures, and you can be placed on the ballot to run for governor. There's no requirement that you run under any party's affiliation. So the access to ballot issue is not a problem.
Right.
What the state did is they've reached in under SB 54 and told private organizations, we're going to rewrite your internal documents and tell you how you move forward and select those that represent your organization. And we believe that's a bridge too far. And we've, not only us, but even legislators that voted for SB 54 raised this concern, saying that we're in uncharted waters now, that we may have gone too far. And the way that you get that question resolved is you take a state action to court and say, Your Honor, we believe that this action by the state has infringed upon our constitutional rights. The court will then answer that question. If they did infringe, they will strike down the law, or they will modify the law and to comport within the constitutional boundaries. And that's the question we're trying to get answered. Exactly what can the state do with respect to private political organizations? Can they reach in and tell a private political organization, you must allow the members in your organization to select candidates this way or that way? That's what we're trying to get answered.
Right. Let me ask you, I wanted to come back to that first question, if I could, the law that was passed, SB 54, again, supported by a majority of Republicans, supported by many of your party's leaders, many of your party's supporters. So have you polled your party? Have you, you know, canvassed your party, taken a vote among the party to get a sense of how they would want you to act? I mean, how do you reconcile the fact that you're filing a lawsuit with the fact that a number of state Republican lawmakers, a number of Republican leaders, a number of Republican supporters went along with the deal that was crafted in the legislative session?
Well, great question. Our governing body voted twice to authorize me to file this lawsuit. Our delegates voted in the last convention for us to move forward. The House sponsor of SB 54, Representative Dan McKay, has placed $1,000 towards us filing the lawsuit. If that gives you any indication about the support for SB 54.
Well, I don't understand then. Why did they pass it?
Well, I'm not going to speak on behalf of the legislature, but the general consensus was it was between bad and worse. There was an element or a sense or a feeling of blackmail by a very powerful individual saying, if you don't compromise here, we're going to move forward with a more draconian measure, which was this citizens initiative. And legislators do what legislators do. They try to make the best of a difficult situation. But we as a party have been consistent in saying whether the citizens initiative that was put forth by Count My Vote passed, or whether the legislature took action in this area and made it law, we were going to ask the courts to resolve the matter. So we have been consistent from the very beginning.
I understand.
And this is going to end up in court one way or another.
Right. I get your philosophical and constitutional objections to the law that was passed, Mr. Evans, that it subverts due process and free association, those kinds of things. But what is the practical effect of the law that you worry about? In effect, what I think supporters of the Count My Vote initiative are saying is that all that's going to happen is you're going to have more voters who will have a crack at candidates earlier in the process. What's wrong with that? More voters will be able to have a say in the process. What practically is wrong with that?
Well, there's something that makes America unique, and that's something called constitutional rights, and they're not subjected to the popular vote or popular sentiment. They're there for a reason. As a private organization, we have certain constitutional protections, and one of them is that as a private organization, we get to set forth how we want those that represent our political philosophy or our brand, how we hold them out. That's not for the state
right.
to dictate.
But what about, put that aside for just a moment, though.
I cannot put our constitutional rights aside.
No, I'm not suggesting, but I want you to comment, if you would, on the practical matter, though, okay? The question of why not just let more people have a say? There's going to be less negotiating, less arm twisting. You're going to put the process back into the hands of more people. Isn't that an important tenet of Republicans?
To answer that question is to answer it this way. I absolutely agree. We want as many people involved as possible. But the question that we're trying to get answered is who gets to make that decision? The Count My Vote group said, we're going to go and have the force of the state make that decision. And what we have been saying is, whatever the final decision is, even if we end up going in that way, has to be a decision that's made by our organization. So they're arguing what should be done. We're arguing who gets to make the decision.
See, you know what a skeptic's going to say, though, don't you? They're going to say that you're not really that interested in the constitutional matter at hand, that you've got the grassroots conservative groups, the delegates that know they're going to lose power, that it's not about the Constitution, it's about their losing power. How do you respond to that?
And welcome to America, because they may get that First Amendment freedom of speech to offer whatever opinion that they choose to offer. But there's so many practical implications here. For instance, under SB 54, we would have to certify by next August, which direction we're going to, whether we're going to become a qualified party or not. That would require us to undertake another $50,000 to $75,000 financial burden to add another convention, for instance, to try to get our governing documents changed, to even comport to this new law. There are just so many burdensome responsibilities that's been forced on us in a short period of time. Even if we wanted to do this, it's a Herculean task.
But how much are you going to pay for this lawsuit? I mean, that's gonna cost some money.
Yeah, well, our lawsuit cost approximately $50,000, and which is going to come back to the principle, which is, does the state have the right to impose these burdens on us?
Right.
If we want to impose them on ourselves, that's our constitutional right. But if the state can impose this on us, they can start imposing burdens on many other private organizations because of the argument about the state's compelling interests. So while some may view it as skeptical, at the end of the day, this is not an outcome-based action. Because some want to have others more involved doesn't mean that the state has the constitutional right to reach in and force our organization to do certain things.
Final question. Let me ask you this finally. You're hearing a lot of concern, I think, among political observers that you're going to create two Republican parties in this process, that this lawsuit and this dispute anyway pits moderates against conservatives. Are you worried about that?
Well, it just seems to me that the ones that keep bringing up brands or characterizing people as moderate conservative, I mean, you may be moderate on one issue and conservative on another, and a lot of the people that they call conservative are conservative on certain issues and moderate on other issues. And so I don't see this so much as moderate conservative as it appears to be an inside group and an outside group. And as a party, as a Republican party, we have always been open to everyone that's Republican, but what we cannot be open to is the state forcing us to dictate to us how we select our nominees. That is just simply too far. And for anyone who says that they're Republican and they're about the rule of law, but more importantly, making sure that constitutional rights are observed, To not want us to get this question answered, and I would ask you this, Doug, what is so extraordinary or about us trying to get this question answered when you had those voting for SB 54 express constitutional concerns, when you have the House sponsor of SB 54 pledge $1,000 for the friendly lawsuit because he wants the constitutional questions resolved? What is so extraordinary about us just trying to get that answer, that those questions answered, so everyone will know where the boundaries are, and moving forward, everyone will then know the landscape and can plan for the future?
I guess what seems extraordinary to some is the fact that a law was passed, that the governor did sign the bill, that there was publicly expressed support from Republican supporters for the law. I guess that's what seems extraordinary, is why couldn't you guys have figured this out before? And now, after the thing has passed, you're now filing a lawsuit.
Well, from the very beginning, the party's position, you can go back and look, we've been very clear that we will assert our constitutional protections and that we will go to court. We've been very clear about that.
But Mr. Evans, all those concerns about the constitutionality of it were expressed during the democratic process that played out during the legislative session, and a vote was taken. And they passed
the
law.
The democratic process is a court of law. That's why we have the checks and balances. Because the presumption that the legislature can always get it right would negate the reasons for having courts.
Right.
So our complete democratic process includes the court system. Do you not agree?
No, I do. I'm just saying, your question was, why does it seem so extraordinary? And that was my response to it. James Evans, chairman of the State Republican Party, joined us from his office in Salt Lake. Mr. Evans, thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me on.
We're going to hear from Kirk Jowers, co-founder of the Count My Vote initiative, when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the lawsuit going to be filed this week by the state's Republican Party to strike down the law that was passed during the last legislative session that would limit the power of party delegates in selecting candidates. Kirk Jowers is joining us now. He's co-founder of the Count My Vote initiative, the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, joining us today by phone. He's in Washington, D.C. And Kirk, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Let me start, I guess, your general reaction to the lawsuit. I don't think anyone was surprised by it. I guess you saw it coming, too.
Sure. I mean, they party leaders threatened at the beginning, depending on when you want to put the marker down. Certainly, when we were getting the signatures, we ended up getting about 115,000 signatures from registered voters in Utah. And then more threatened lawsuits after Governor Herbert signed the legislation. We had, and then publicly, of course, at the Republican Organizing Convention, where party leaders again said, should we file suit? And the delegates said yes. And so we thought it would be earlier, and I know that's what the Lieutenant Governor's office had asked, is if you feel like you need to do this, do it early so that we don't waste a lot of state money getting ready for the new system and the delays that could occur. But the short answer is we knew it was going to happen. And I actually have been in some discussions with Chairman Evans over the months about the possibility of it.
It seems like if you boil down, at least if you were to take him at his word, James Evans, this isn't about consolidating power for, extremists in the party. In fact, all they care about, he seems to say, is this constitutional question of whether or not any governmental entity, in this case the state, can dictate to a private entity, as he's pointing out, the party is, how it can choose its candidates. I mean, that's his legal question, that it can't constitutionally, that cannot happen. What do you make of that as a legal argument?
Almost nothing, to be honest, and not to be flippant about it. It's just almost one of the more embarrassing things about having spent so much of my last few years working on this reform is that it's not groundbreaking. It's not a transformative new thing that everyone's looking at. This is a reform that began really with during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency, so the early 1900s, which transformed a nation of states which mostly had our kind of caucus convention. Teddy Roosevelt would have set a party boss system, and they moved to more direct primaries in order to break the stranglehold of the few and empower more people. Utah's is coming into this reform about 100 years after most of the country, and so we have significant Supreme Court precedent as well as lower court precedent, and we've got 43 states that have preceded Utah in making this move. And so we know from the Supreme Court, in fact, the Supreme Court has said it is too plain for argument that we can, that the state can make this change. Add to the to all of these national precedents, we had 15 former Utah State Bar presidents, Republican, Democrat, and unaffiliated, all signed a letter 2 years ago saying that they agreed with the legal reasoning that this was a constitutional move. And then we have the added benefit of our Republican and Democratic legislators and Republican governor and the legislative council who all looked at this law, looked at the precedent, and said it is a constitutional move. And so there just really is not a lot on the other side. And so and that's been my discussion with James throughout is, you know, if there's a constitutional issue, why does nobody else see it?
So who's dictating the decision? He said that their party committee, he's canvassed certainly leaders here. Seems like there's a disconnect, or maybe a disconnect, at least from your perspective, between the moderates in the party and those who seem to be in control right now.
I can't speak for that. Certainly, the delegates were quite clear in their dictates to Chairman Evans on that they were not pleased with not being able to kind of be a buffer between the candidates and the Republican voters and other state voters. My argument to him has always been, why listen to the 5 or 10% when we know quite clearly that somewhere over 70% of your Republicans, much less you know, the state, which is closer to 80%, support reforming and updating our election process. And you know, the benefits are so clear, and you look at military voters, women, and the list goes on and on, people who actually have to work, healthcare workers, for example, during this time. It's the only, Utah was maintaining the only election in the United States that was at one place and one time, and there was no ability to vote early or vote in absentee, and the only one where they could keep someone like an Olene Walker or a Senator Bennett, who enjoyed 81% and over 70% approval ratings, from even appearing on a public ballot.
How do you respond to James Evans' contention, although he didn't make it here on this? Well, he did, I suppose. He was talking about how the fact that, that this process is only going to be accessible if you reform it the way you intend, Kirk Jowers. It's only going to be accessible to elites because there's such an obstacle to raising money, to getting on a ballot, that it's going to be the common person, I suppose, as it's been put, won't have access to run for office.
And I just think that's completely false, both by, you know, looking around the country again. Utah received failing grades from Pew and other national groups looking at our accessibility to the ballot. What you will see in the future is to many people, I think SB 54 creates the perfect hybrid. It does allow people to gather signatures to appear on the primary ballot. It also allows candidates to go through our caucus convention system. And so I would disagree with the premise that the caucus convention system is, you know, enabling to, you know, the financially disadvantaged, because Utah is by far the most expensive election in the country per voter. There's no state even close, and we certainly have seen Senator Hatch, who spent, you know, somewhere north of $6 million to get out of convention. You can kind of go through the lists of that. But if there is any credibility to that, that system still exists under SB 54. And so if someone can run an effective low dollar campaign and get 60% at the convention, or even over 40%, then they will make it to the primary, as well as the people who just go out and gather signatures to make it onto the primary ballot.
So we're at the point now where the state is going to have to defend the lawsuit. You've got the Attorney General, who's been pretty outspoken in his opposition to SB 54, at least the concept of it. Do you feel confident that Mr. Reyes, Sean Reyes, is going to be able to defend the law properly?
Absolutely, I do. I've had several discussions with Sean Reyes on a number of things. In fact, he was kind enough to reference me twice in his debate, as far as someone he's consulted with and how to structure the office in making it more ethical. And so I've had opportunities to discuss it with him, and I think his statement was clear to the public recently that he would, you know, defend it. And I've met with Brian Tarbett, who has been taking a laboring oar on the issue from the Attorney General's office, as well as the Lieutenant Governor's office. And I feel very confident in both their knowledge of the legal arguments and the legal issues, as well as their, you know, commitment to defending the law, which was passed by our legislature and signed by our governor.
What did you make of James? I'm not sure if you were able to hear them. I'll just mention James Evans said that some state lawmakers, including the sponsor of SB 54, are rethinking their support for it. What did you make of that?
I think it's unfortunate if one of the sponsors is going to do that, but it frankly doesn't surprise me throughout the negotiations. And one thing I did take note of when Chairman Evans was talking was, you know, he said something like, the Count My Vote people blackmailed the legislators into it, or I'm not sure if it's quite that outlandish. But
no, I used that word.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to. But that we pressured, or I guess he did use the word of blackmailing. You know, to be clear, for the last several years, we tried to work with the party, both parties, actually all four parties, as well as with the legislature, to see if there was a way to get around having to do the initiative. And we got majority votes in the Republican Party, even among the delegates, to change the system. But we needed supermajorities in order to change it and empower citizens a little bit. It wouldn't have been as far-reaching as Count My Vote or SB 54, and it didn't happen. So we then went to the initiative process, gathered 115,000 signatures, were qualified to get on the ballot, and the legislative leaders came to us and said, we really regret, and James Evans has told me this as well, that they regret not having done something earlier. We'd like to see if we can work out a deal. And so that's what SB 54 was, you know, legislative leaders approached us to see if there was a way that we could keep the caucus convention system, but also modernize our system enough and so that we don't disenfranchise, you know, the military and underrepresent women and some of the other huge issues with our system.
Kirk, let me ask you this finally. So you seem pretty confident that this lawsuit isn't going to go anywhere, but what happens if you have efforts with among lawmakers to try to repeal the law, or if the lawsuit in some sense does go forward? Have you thought about what happens next? I mean, do you just go back to the process you had before, where you were collecting signatures and trying to get it on the ballot just for voters?
As a worst case scenario, I think everyone, including the donors, and just, you know, with the near 80% approval in the state, that would probably be what would have to happen. I am confident in the legal analysis of our team and you know, the 15 former bar presidents, Supreme Court precedent, etc. It is a severable bill, meaning if they do find some little part that needs a technical change or has an issue, then the rest of it goes into place, and so that certainly gives me comfort. And then as far as the legislative action, I've just heard from so many legislators that yes, there are a few people who want to make changes and want to curry favor with you know, with the more extreme members or delegates who want to keep their own power, but they just said it will never happen, that they are resolved to moving forward. So I take them at their word, and so I don't think we'll ever have to get to that hypothetical.
It's Kirk Jowers. He's one of the co-founders of the Count My Vote initiative, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. Kirk, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
I wanted to end with some perspective from Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune and Brian Grimmett of KUER News. How are you reacting to what you're hearing? I mean, it seems like James Evans is trying to set this up as a fairly clear constitutional issue. Kirk
right.
Jowers dismisses it pretty much out of hand.
Right. Well, and the point that James didn't really address is that the primary elections are state-run. I mean, the state pays for that. Taxpayers pay for that. So the state sets the ground rules for who gets on the ballot. So that's the leverage that the state has in this argument. If the party wants to pay for its own primary elections, I suppose that's an option that they could pursue, but that's expensive and they can't afford that. So, you know, and I think, you know, so that's one of the obstacles that they're going to have to overcome. One of the things that Kirk mentioned and maybe dismissed is that there is an effort by some legislators to try to repeal SB 54. Senator Scott Jenkins, who was an opponent of SB 54 right. last time, has a constitutional amendment he wants to run again that would give the party complete authority to pick its candidates how it wants.
But how realistic is that?
Well, to get 2/3 is, you know, for a constitutional amendment is a hard lift at any time. And I think given the support that SB 54 got last time and the compromise to sort of roll that back would be difficult. And there are, you know, Senator Kurt Bramble, who was the sponsor of SB 54, has been pretty adamant that he's going to try to prevent any changes to that, because he feels like there was a deal that was struck and they're going to stick by that deal.
What are you expecting?
Well, the other issue that might come up along with legislation is the issue of plurality. Rather than just eliminating the SB 54, because like Robert was saying, that, you know, they, at least Senator Bramble says, you know, that's the deal we made, that's what we want to stay. But there's this issue of, well, what if there's multiple candidates and nobody gets a majority of the vote? And that's a problem that they see that they might address, and they could send that back to the delegates. And they haven't, no one has said that that's what they're going to do, but that's one of the options out there. I also think it's interesting that it almost seems that James Evans and some of those who are fighting against this, they almost see this idea of a primary is a radical idea, but it's not. I mean, most states out there, that's how they select their candidates, is through a primary. I mean, I grew up in Texas, and that's how they do it. You're Republican, you vote for the primary, and there's a runoff if there's no majority. And so this isn't a radical idea. So it'll be interesting to see where their argument comes from, because several other states do it the same way.
This model that they have in place now is almost identical to what Connecticut has, and so, in fact, I believe it was patterned after that. And so, it does. There is precedent for it in other states. And so that's going to be something to look for. But, you know, you kind of you can kind of see where James is coming from, where the party is the party and they have a brand that they've created. And I don't think you would want me to come in and say, I'm going to be the new host of Radio West because I've, you know, gathered a bunch of signatures, you know, so they want to be able to control that. And that's what they're fighting for. And I think, but as Kirk mentioned, they still have that avenue where they can go through the caucus and convention system or through the primary system. And so this hybrid doesn't eliminate that. They still have that avenue to pursue.
We're about out of time. I wanted to get to the more sort of crass question of who benefits politically. Are you getting a sense of that right now? If under a new caucus system, more moderate figures may emerge. Do you have a sense of that?
Well, it's kind of interesting because we just had an election where there are 105 or roughly 100 legislative races out there, and probably only five or six of them were actually competitive. We had very low voter turnout. I think what was a 46% voter turnout. So it's hard to see a scenario where it would not help voter turnout to have more moderate candidates, more competitive elections. And I think, you know, I think James has, when he raises the point of the political elite or the insiders who are trying to keep control, I think maybe this does give them a little, does let them retain control of the power that they've exercised over, you know, dozens of years.
Yeah, I think it is between those political elite, so-called, and whether or not they can gain from this. And I think that's why there's this big push for 2016. I think Senator Lee's Senate seat is a big issue for a lot of people. And that's kind of, I mean, I don't think it's all focused on that, but I definitely think that is part of the motivation. Is we got to get this in place before that election so that maybe we can get a more moderate candidate to go against him. Someone who can challenge him. Because the delegates love him. They just love him.
There is some concern from the Lee camp that if this is in effect in 2016, he's more vulnerable than he would be as going through the Cox convention system where he's very popular. That's a very good point.
We're so out of time, but I have to ask, does Jim Matheson benefit if they change the system or not? I mean, it seems like it's in his interest that it just stays the way it is.
It probably doesn't affect him that much because he's not going to have a serious challenge if he goes through the caucus convention system at a statewide level.
I do think he has a better chance against a Lee than he does a more moderate candidate, though. So,
well, that's all true. Speculation. He hasn't even
got a few years to work. Let that work out. Huh?
Lots of speculation.
Brian Grimmett, reporter, online editor for KUER News. Brian, thanks very much. Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks again.
Thanks. Always fun.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.